You are listening to the Brennan Center Podcast. Find us on the web at www.brennancenter.org.
Good afternoon. Welcome to our Brennan Center book talk today, where we are featuring the book entitled Blackball, The Black Vote and U.S. Democracy by author Daryl Pinkney. We are very excited today to be hosting this discussion. As I'm sure most of you know, we are in a historic year. This marks the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Voting Rights Act, which to many of us and many historians is indeed one of the most important pieces of civil rights legislation ever enacted in the United States. We are happy to be celebrating this historic landmark, and we also know that this is the 50th anniversary of the historic Selma March. There are people in the room who I'm bonded with because we were all in Selma together, so I'm happy to see them here today. So we thought at the Brennan Center that we wanted to obviously do our part to recognize this historic moment and to really engage all of you in conversation, not just about the history, but what it portends for where we are going as a country and as a democracy. We know that the historic decision in Shelby County versus Holder in 2013 changed the landscape for all of us, for what it means for protecting the vote and what it means for getting more people enfranchised. So we are happy today to have this discussion, and Daryl's book is so on point and is so timely. So we thank you for being here and are looking forward to today's discussion. To kick us off, I'd like to introduce Wade Henderson, who is the president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. As many of you know, the Leadership Conference is the nation's premier civil rights organization that is made up of a coalition of many organizations, of which the Brennan Center is a part. And it really is the eyes, ears, and mouthpiece of civil rights in the United States. And we are so happy to be led by Wade Henderson. So Wade, I'm going to ask you to come up and just give us a few opening remarks.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. As Nicole says, I am Wade Henderson. I do head the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. And as we say, we are the nation's premier civil and human rights coalition, working to build an America as good as its ideals. And it's a motto that we think really serves us well. Now, I'm especially pleased to be here today with you to talk with Daryl Pinkney about his new book, Blackballed, The Black Vote and U.S. Democracy. I want to thank Nicole Austin Hillary and the Brennan Center for inviting me to be here today to provide introductory remarks. And by the way, this is an outstanding facility. Who knew that NYU was so well represented here in Washington? It's a lovely place. Thanks, Nicole. Daryl's book does a tremendous job of documenting the long fight for African American voting rights, from Reconstruction through the 2012 election. This is a fight in which advocates around the country are still engaged at this very moment. This is a fight that is harder to win now because of tactics of voter disfranchisement that are much more subtle than the previous efforts of poll taxes and grandfather clauses and barring people from voting if they couldn't give you the Constitution read backwards, that kind of thing. But they are certainly no less pernicious. Voter ID requirements, shortened early voting periods, limits on poll worker assistance, proof of citizenship requirements, restrictions on same-day and third-party registration, and felon disfranchisement all deny access to the polls to our friends, families, and neighbors, and do an as effective job of excluding voters as any of those really old tactics that I lifted up just a minute ago. So Blackballed arrives at a most auspicious time, a time that's vitally important to the national conversation around voting rights in America. Just 2 weeks ago, as Nicole mentioned, we commemorated the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, an iconic moment in the resistance to civil rights that remains etched in our collective memory because of its violence and brutality. No one will ever forget how Alabama state troopers and a county posse armed with billy clubs and tear gas attacked the unarmed men and women who were peacefully protesting, leaving many bloody and unconscious. The cruelty of that fateful day, captured and broadcast around the world by news organizations, forced the federal government to act. 8 days later, President Johnson addressed a joint session of Congress, and by August of that year, the Voting Rights Act passed by Congress and was signed into law by the President. We find ourselves commemorating this year, the 50th anniversary of seminal voting rights events in our history, at the same time that we are facing renewed challenges to ensuring that every single eligible American can vote. And this is an especially cruel irony. Almost 2 years ago, and again, as Nicole mentioned, in the Shelby County versus Holder Supreme Court decision, gutted the Voting Rights Act of its most effective provision. Last year, Congress introduced a bipartisan bill, the Voting Rights Amendment Act, to address that decision. But incredibly, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Congressman Bob Goodlatte from Virginia, has declared that it is not necessary to restore the Voting Rights Act, despite all the evidence that racial discrimination in voting is still a problem. Last year, he refused to even hold a hearing on the Voting Rights Amendment Act, let alone consider the bill in committee. Now, we remain committed to fixing the Shelby decision and restoring the Voting Rights Act to its prior stature. Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin, Republican, and Congressman John Conyers of Michigan, we introduced the Voting Rights Amendment Act just a few weeks ago. And while it's not a perfect bill, it is a serious first step in a process that civil and human rights advocates have been urging Congress to undertake since the Shelby decision was handed down. Now, Darrell's book provides an important context to help us understand how our current fights for voting rights are indelibly linked to the fights of the past. Truly, as William Faulkner once wrote, the past is never dead. It's not even past. We are part of a grand tradition of activists who dared to demand equal treatment and full citizenship for African Americans and indeed for all Americans. I really look forward to the conversation that follows. I'm sure you do as well. So please join me in thanking Nicole and in welcoming Darrell Pinkney here to the
Thank you, Wade. For those of you who don't know, I tell Wade all the time I want to be him when I grow up. And you now know why. We're going to jump right into this. But I do want to briefly give you just a short introduction about Darrell and who he is and why his work is so important. Darrell is a long-time contributor to the New York Review of Books. He's also the author of several other important books. If you haven't had a chance to read them, I urge you to do so. They include High Cotton and Out There, Mavericks of Black Literature. He's also worked for Robert Wilson on various theatrical projects. We just realized that we have a love of theater and a background in theater in common. And he has worked most recently on an adaptation of Danielle Carm's The Old Woman. So we are happy to have you here today, Darrell, and to engage us in this conversation. Tell us this, and you see I have lots of bookmarks, Darrell, because I was very engaged in reading this book. And I want to talk about this book and your work in kind of different components. One, I'd like to talk about what was the catalyst for this book and what brought you to this. And then I'd like to talk about some of that history that we know has brought us to this point. You know, what is it about American democracy that has given us the kind of rich history we have with respect to the black vote? And then I'd like to talk about where we are now and what that portends for the future. As we all just heard Wade say, we are in a very important moment. There is legislation that's pending right now to try to restore what we lost after the Shelby County decision. We have our first African-American president who was in the final 2 years of his term. And so I think we want to engage in what does all of that mean for the future of not just the black vote, but for the minority vote going forward, particularly now that we know that the demographics of the United States are quickly changing and will continue to change. So why don't we start with what was the genesis for this? What inspired you to write this book?
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you all for coming. I'm very grateful to Mr. Anderson for his kind remarks, and delighted to be here with you. stunning.
Thank you.
Not supposed to say things.
It's okay.
I was asked to give the Robert B. Silvers lecture at the New York Public Library in 2012, and it seemed the moment to do this, to talk about this subject. I lived abroad for over 20 years. I believed in that black expatriate thing. Baldwin kind of haunted my youth, and so I left. It was to get away from lots of things, America in particular. And away is not as away as it used to be when your parents were phoning you every weekend. And my father used to drive me crazy. He was a really passionate civil rights activist of the rank and file kind. For the NAACP, he never wanted to be on the national board or anything like that. It was always local, rank and file, all the time. I think that he came from that sort of tradition where there was no class distinction in the black experience. The whites didn't care if you had a Phi Beta Kappa key or not. When they arrested you and beat you up, that kind of thing. I think that because of the NAACP, the way it's organized, there were people who could engage in challenges to segregation and racism without having to worry about what their bosses said. And so my father would do things like sue the Indianapolis Police Department on his own, and he won. He sued the Indianapolis Fire Department on his own, and he won. He made the airport desegregate their workforce, things like that. He was not a popular guy in town. There were sometimes headlines that he was stealing NAACP funds from the local paper, and, or that he was dealing drugs. These headlines, you know, The story taking it back was always on page 16, some tiny thing down in the corner. In the end, he became rather paranoid and distressed all the time. My parents had lived together for decades and decades and decades since they were college. They'd known each other since college. And my mother had no choice but to, in a way, become paranoid with him, or else, you know, there was no marital harmony. And I could see in a lot of 60s figures and movement types certain kind of damage from what they'd been through, mostly having to do with no one believing them, or for them it was just never going to be over. And I sort of wanted to get away from all that. But at the same time, I used my parents and my family as my conscience. As long as they were involved, I didn't have to be. I could just sit in Europe and go to the opera, and my parents would take care of that for me. As long as I voted absentee every 4 years, I'd done my bit. I can remember talking to them on the phone during the O.J. Simpson trial and thinking they'd lost their minds, you know, because if you weren't here, you didn't have that day-to-day saturation in the story, the way everyone who was still here was sort of fixed on it. And so, you know, I valued my distance. And then my parents died, and I realized how much I depended on them for the things I wrote. I would ask them what books I should read, or what was the source for, or did they remember? And they always had an answer, they always knew. I'm glad that I'd had the sense and the time to tell them how much these things meant to me before they died, since I'd spent so much time trying to get away from them, trying not to listen, trying to pretend, oh, that's not going to happen to my generation, or, well, we're free, we don't have those problems, or anything like that. I'm glad I kind of made it up to them in some ways. And so this book, this history of trying to get the vote, is constructed entirely from, except for the last two books I mentioned in the text, entirely from things that had come from my father's shelves, things he'd urged me to read that I'd just sort of say, later. I'm reading Virginia Woolf now. So it's an act of contrition in part. It's certainly an exploration in the philosophy that governed how family life worked for me. And I see now in the way my parents went about their daily local activities that the struggle is never over. You don't win and then go home and that's that. When the Voting Rights Act was passed, the opposition to it was immediate and it never stopped, as we found out. Same is true for Brown versus Board of Education. The opposition to that was immediate, it never stopped, and actually Brown versus Board of Education has never really been implemented in this country, not really. And so I saw in their tireless, dull, show up every day way that, you know, the struggle has to be kind of part of your personal life in order to make sense or to work. There's no big thing you go to and then you go home and that's that. That actually, it asks a lot of you. And my parents weren't doing this for themselves because, according to American definitions, they were wildly successful. They were doing this out of faith, what they believed. And I sort of came to understand that the freedom struggle, and not just black history, because my parents thought that human rights was and civil rights applied to everyone, not just to black people. But that the freedom struggle was the church I grew up in, because, you know, my parents didn't care so much about Sunday or anything like that. It was purely social, and my mother just liked the music of high church. But their faith was really, yes, the Constitution. That was their sort of Bible. So I wrote all of that to make my contribution to the family story in a way. Is that a long, boring answer?
No, it was so interesting. Okay. You hear how quiet it is in this room? I just have to add this too, Daryl. I think it's somewhat of a love story too, to your parents. A love letter to your parents.
Yeah.
I felt that reading this. Yeah. Let me ask you this, because you spend a lot of time clearly in the beginning of the book going through the history and talking about, you know, the vote and how white America tried to make it very difficult for blacks and other minorities to engage in the electoral process. How does the right to vote undergird our democracy in a way that is perhaps different from some of the other civil rights protections that we fought for? You've already mentioned Brown. Of course, we fought for to end housing discrimination, to end discrimination in education. But no fight seems to be as grounded in American history, as nasty, as long-standing as the fight for the vote. Why is that? What does that particular right, that privilege, represent in American history, such that it is such an important right for us to protect and such an important right for some others to try to keep from some people in this country?
Clearly, the answer is in our founding principles and the history of the Republic. You know, we said that we weren't going to be like George III and that over there. We're going to be like this Enlightenment experiment. But the founding fathers were ambivalent from the very beginning, as everyone knows, not just in the slaves or three-fifths of a person, but also in the anxiety about poor people voting, men who didn't have property. They couldn't be trusted entirely. And so to vote really says you belong. It's an act of sort of the act defining citizenship, more so than serving in a war, I think. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I'm not sure. But it's certainly up there as what, you know, what as a citizen, how you participate in the country's political and social life. And so there's always been this tension between what the Constitution says and clearly what it means and the reality, the historical circumstance from era to era. And it's always been some people resisting new people because to some people it belongs to them. You know, you can play as long as you play by our rules, or you can join in as long as we get to sort of set the terms, as long as we still feel we're in control. You know, the opposition to voting among conservatives hasn't changed, the reasons for it haven't changed since the Constitutional Convention in the 18th century, and especially not since immigrant groups joined, the ranks in the late 19th century. And it sort of divides along the lines of, is voting a right or is it a privilege? And voter suppression is very much a part of U.S. history. In the late 19th century in New York State, for instance, it just so happened that in a couple of elections, voter registration days happened to fall on Yom Kippur and one of the other Jewish holidays. Rosh Hashanah, I think it may have been, okay. You know, that, you know, to sort of keep these people from registering. So the same radical Republicans who supported the vote for Friedman were opposed to the Chinese workers building the railroads having the vote. So it's always been sort of patchwork kind of thing. And I think that it often is, the vote is the drama between states' rights and the federal government. And so this tension is alive and ongoing. And also these days, you know, Citizens United is probably the worst decision since, I don't know, Plessy versus Ferguson. And so this sort of millions of dollars are polluting our political system. But I sort of think that, you know, they're not just spending to convince you to vote for their guy. They're trying to keep you from voting. And so the thing I don't understand is, given how the effort put in to keep people from voting, why voting isn't understood as a radical act, why it doesn't attract people as a sort of radical gesture, which by this time it certainly is. But, you know, midterm voting turnout has been a problem since 1843, when the turnout was, I think, 46%, no, 37%. Even in 1940, when the world was at war, the voter turnout didn't go above 42% in America. And I can't explain that. But I think that the vote, because it sort of says you're a citizen, you're participating, and that decisions come from this, I think that, you know, it's not meaningless. It does mean something. I can't bear hip friends who say it doesn't matter which party wins. And you know they've grown up white, not black, because you're not just voting for president. You're voting for the Supreme Court. You're voting for lots of judicial appointees, never mind sort of policies.
And you're also voting for all of those local elected officials. This is the thing that I can't quite understand, is how Americans don't quite get that so much of your voice and power comes from the local electeds on up. I mean, we all know that all politics is local. And people are not just not voting for the Supreme Court and for judicial appointments, they're also not making determinations about actually what happens in their own backyards and in their own communities.
Yeah.
Tell me this, Daryl, because as I listen to you and as I think back to some parts of the book, it sounds like actually that the history of this country has not just been an effort to keep blacks from voting, but anybody who fits into the other category.
Yes.
Okay, let's talk about that a little bit.
You know, the Klan, okay, we had the Klan in the 19th century after the Civil War, and then it kind of went away. In 1920, the Klan reemerged very active in Indiana in 1920 for one principal reason. So many black women had tried to vote under the, is it the 19th Amendment?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That they thought, oh, you know, not only is my wife and my sister and my mother, you know, trying to vote, the maid's trying to vote too. I can't have this. You know, so, you know, yes, I think that there is this tendency to think that, well, sorry, white guys, but, you know, white guys thinks it's ours. And everyone else has to kind of pass through us in order to be a part of it. I mean, I was talking to someone earlier, perhaps it was you, that, you know, the disrespect shown Obama is really fury that a black guy is in charge of the money. Not that he's in the White House, but that he's in charge of the money. They can't handle it. They really can't. It's, you know, against the laws of nature to work for a black man. It's just sort of, you know, not done. And I sort of think that is a real problem. You know, the idea of to whom does the country belong? But, you know, every black writer has said, generation after generation, no one gives you anything. You sort of take it or win power yourself. And so I still don't understand, if you're talking about we must hold the police accountable, why don't you vote for the people who hire them? You know. And yet you read in the New York Times, a lot of people in Ferguson don't even know when the upcoming election is to be held. How's this possible? What's happening that, you know, I don't know, that somehow the urgency of the matter is not filtering through. It's partly, I think, psychological. And so, in a way, it's good that Selma reminds us of ordinary sacrifice or people who turn themselves into heroes by putting their bodies on the line, really. That, you know, it's within our grasp. We can sort of do it. So the real irony for me is that having been oppressed and victimized, black people and other people are turning out to be the defenders of the state, you know, against the very people who once thought they owned the state, you know. But I wonder if we're not already too damaged. Too much like the societies we feel sorry for, or the countries we feel sorry for, where the state and the society don't have that much to do with each other, that people try to live ignored by the government or under the radar of the government or distant from the government. I wonder if there isn't somehow the sadness that America has become much more like the rest of the world and much less like itself.
So do we need a new movement?
We have a new movement.
And that is what?
Well, I thought it was Ferguson, but something seems to be not quite growing the way I thought. You know, it's not enough to... I was talking to one gifted organizer here, and it's not enough to turn into danger junkies and following police confrontations. You know, somehow, what the youth were talking about in Ferguson has to be enlarged and encouraged. Why aren't those young people helping to write a federal jobs bill? We all know our infrastructure needs to be rebuilt. Why aren't we teaching the young activists how to propose this kind of thing? or if we can get out of Afghanistan or in Iraq, why can't we get out of the war on drugs? Since the war on drugs and racial profiling has a lot to do with the things that are going wrong on the racial front in America at the moment. If we repealed the war on drugs and put that money elsewhere, it'd be a great improvement right away.
Do you think that people by and large see the connection between the vote and amassing political power and actually dealing with some of these other issues that you've just outlined? Like, do we need to do a better job of making that connection and helping the rest of the country to see that it is through the vote and through the ballot box that you actually get to do things like address jobs and police community relations and housing and education and these other things? And is that the way we need to galvanize the movement?
Well, I think so, but, you know, as I said, day-to-day activism is really boring. You know, and really hard, and there are so many other distractions and things people would rather do. Mm-hmm. It is a sacrifice. But I think that's maybe one of the things we have to return to, that being a citizen, being a part, helping to build the country, to make its future, requires sacrifice. You don't just get to sort of withdraw the benefits mm-hmm. of citizenship. You have to pay in, and pay in more than just taxes, though to say that like that is saying something. That, you know, actually you have to be bored for a bit and pay attention to local politics and things like that because it's important. Mm-hmm. We know what it's like not to be a part of it. We see all of that. It's all around us. We should try something different, which is to become involved.
But how do we get people engaged? You know, as I was going through the history, and I was thinking about various historical examples as I was reading your book, dramatic things happened in the 1960s. You had people being beaten. You had people losing their lives. You had churches being bombed. And certainly we don't want to return to an era where we have that kind of, those kinds of dramatic incidences happening. But those are the things that actually woke America up. What is it that we need to do to get people to even realize why this is so important and to stop being bored? You know, when things happen in the news, you know, just yesterday, the Supreme Court decided not to take on the Wisconsin voter ID issue. And for those of us in the voting rights community, that was a big deal. We had emails going all over the place, and we were all trying to figure out what the... It's a conspiracy. and we were all trying to figure out... you know, what does this mean? What does this mean for our movement? But I don't know that that meant anything to America writ large. And we want these things to matter to America writ large. So what kind of things do we need to try to do as advocates to try to get the American public more engaged the way many of them were in the 60s? And I recognize that revisionist history changes things, that perhaps we look back now and we think, oh, all of America was galvanized and was focused on voting rights. And we know that's not true. No. We know that's not true. No. But we do know that there were things that happened that ensured that a significant amount of Americans were engaged enough to make a difference. What has to change now? What do we have to do to bring about that same engagement? And I know the mic's not working, but I have a big mouth. That's what comes from a theater background, so I'm going to keep talking.
You keep talking. Okay. I'm just going to press this button.
All right. Thanks.
That should work.
Well, that's a large question. I mean, in some ways, the political will is there. I think the Affordable Health Care Act passed because, in spite of the enormous campaign against it, people got on the phones to their congressmen and said, what are you talking about? We want this. So actually, the political will is there. Around Ferguson and Staten Island and all this sort of thing, there was a mass response. Lots of white kids lying down in the street, shutting down shopping malls, The political will is there. You don't have to explain racism to these kids. They've taken all these classes. They know all about that. Mm-hmm. You know, and so they're ready in a way. It was there. It's just a matter of building on somehow. But I don't know how to do that. I'm not an organizer, and I'm not even a very good member of organizations. And so I'm sitting here slightly with a guilty conscience saying, you ought to do this and this and that. And, of course, I'm going to get on YouTube as soon as I go home. But I think, you know, it sort of will build. I'm very pessimistic in the short term and optimistic in the long run. I mean, the Republicans can read the demographic future as well as all of us. 2%, no. 50% of the country under the age of 2 years old belongs to a minority. 33% of the eligible voters are single mothers. You know, so the White House is not going to be in Republican hands with these statistics anytime soon, so they're doing what they can to hold on to state and local power. Because, of course, a lot of that is involved with purse strings and how, you know, government and business, how they conduct themselves on the local level. It's been something most people have always been excluded from, local government. You don't know when they meet. You can't afford to be a council person because the stipend is inadequate. Or, you know, just sort of all these sort of reasons. But something about the culture of local governance must change in a way. Why does St. Louis have 90 municipalities? You know, it's not working. You know, that some of this has to be reimagined. But I think that the young have to be a major part of the conversation. These young girls who are leading the Ferguson movement, why aren't they being sort of, I don't know, taught more sort of skills or brought into organizations that are working on job bills or things like that? You know, I think that there has to be some reaching out to them. And then this is maybe not a minor thing and maybe not unrelated, just part of more rambling thoughts. Listening to sort of hip-hop and all that, it's got nothing in it. Why aren't these people using their enormous popularity or reach to say something more than just sort of women, money, drugs, and bling, you know? I think, you know, somehow we have to turn a corner in the way we think about ourselves. And Occupy Wall Street was important in that way, too.
Well, all of this leads me to the essay that you added at the end of the book. Entitled What Black Means Now. I want to talk about that some, and I want to talk about that in the context of all the things you just touched on, but pointedly I want to talk about it related to Mr. Obama and his presidency. Clearly, and you note this in the book, it brought a lot of African Americans to the polls in record numbers that we had not seen before. So when we talk about the history of the black vote, and that's, I guess, one would say that was the pinnacle of that history in terms of political participation in the African-American community. What does that portend for the future? Because we're not going to have a Barack Obama on the ballot the next time around. We might not have anyone who looks like a Barack Obama on the ballot for a long time to come. So what does all of that mean for political participation for the African-American community and keeping people engaged? I would hope, when you talk about optimism and pessimism, I hope that it is about more than that man, that one individual who happens to be on the ballot, and it's about more so about what people think they can achieve as a people and as a nation. But I'd love to hear your thoughts about what you see for the future, given that Mr. Obama is ending his presidency, and also talk about what has that presidency meant for Black America and the rest of America in terms of our democracy.
He'll be the first president since Taft to also be a Supreme Court justice.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah. Yeah.
Who's going to nominate him?
Hillary.
And what Senate's going to confirm him?
Hillary.
Okay.
Hillary. You know, the Reagan era was so awful in many ways, and one of the things it did was really to undercut this new black middle class mm-hmm. that had, you know, sort of emerged at the end of the 70s and in the early 80s. He just sort of cut back everything, and black people were the first to lose out and in a way never regained the economic momentum. Mm-hmm. You know, and so the discrepancies and disparities are what they were in 1960. I think that the old argument in black politics about trusting whites or doing it by ourselves, separatism, that have been answered by Carol Mosley Brown and Obama's election in Illinois, and then finally his election to the presidency. These are coalitions. Mm-hmm. The Hyde Park Coalition. It's, you know, the new one since the New Deal Coalition. And it's the Republican side. You know, that juggernaut has kind of fallen apart. And so it's a real opportunity for, you know, a new sort of force to dictate the political agenda. And it would be these sort of coalitions, women, gays, you know, anyone who's not a white guy. Sorry. you know, there's that, I think. I think that the next president will be a woman, mm-hmm. yeah. And I think it will be Hillary. And I know there are a lot of Elizabeth Warren people here, but she can beat anybody, is my feeling. And I sort of want to get her in. I feel that way, you know, as much as I admire Cornel West, I'm not interested in Obama from criticism of the left. Mm-hmm. It's not really the problem we're facing. If you look at the right wing, you know, this sort of leftist being disappointed in Obama is nuts, really, considering what there really is ahead of us. He gets no credit for saving Wall Street. I'm not arguing about whether he should or not. He gets no credit for it. Mm-hmm. The economy didn't go into meltdown. He gets no credit for it. I don't think he should have turned to Larry Summers and people like that, but never mind. That's just me. There's no way anyone who has a shot at the presidency is as to the left as I am, and I just don't expect it. You know, it's just not going to happen. And then, you know, I think that he really does believe that the country has a chance to reconcile in him because of his personal history. And he really kind of stuck to it. The one thing he's done is kept the middle of the road. They can't make him lose his cool, and they can't force him from the middle ground. Mm-hmm. He's there. And as long as he's in the middle ground, defining the mainstream, the Republicans are always going to look crazy and sort of right-wing and all that. It's one of the things he's done. But also in his second inaugural, his language was very different in character from the first. And it's because he knew the world was listening. And he wanted people around the world who spoke English to be able to hear him clearly. Because he's president of the world in a way. And the rest of the world looks at him very differently from the way the US does. You know, reporting about Obama outside the US is so different, it makes me feel I made a mistake coming back. No, because the one thing I can't bear is to hear the right wing on and on and on TV, on radio, and you know, it's just exhausting. And that's the sort of purpose of it, is to wear everybody out, to kill discussion. Mm-hmm. Obama in the first campaign stopped and gave his speech in Philadelphia, people were running around as though, my God, this is magnificent. And actually what it was the first time in a long time anyone had heard the black point of view without its being immediately surrounded by voices of neoconservatism taking issue with it and saying, this is not true, that's not true, that's not true. You know, it was just the way he saw things. And it was, you know, an ordinary conversation any black would have had, but it seemed remarkable because we hadn't heard it in a long time. You know, people act as though they're sick of hearing the black point of view, but actually, you never hear the black point of view. You know, you really don't. It's always been a struggle to be heard. This is sort of what black literature has always been about. I think that social media is a big part of the answer. Twitter and Facebook kept a lot of people in line in the last election when people were saying, oh, the polls are closed or they're not open. And the social media said, that's not true. Here they are, here they are, here they are. Facebook developed an app that registered voters, and they calculate they may have added 320,000 new voters to the rolls, most of whom are Democrats. So I think that social media is in some ways bringing that direct democracy that the founding fathers had been uncertain about.
Daryl, let me ask you about this.
I'm just rambling in my answers because I don't know any more than, well, you guys know more than I do, as you suddenly realize, right?
No, this is a conversation. It's not a test. There are no right or wrong answers.
I understood there'd be no trigonometry on this.
None. Lawyers don't like math, so no, there will be none of that. Let me ask you this, and then I want to open it up to all of you because I know people have questions. Just as I'm listening to you and I'm thinking about the Obama presidency, and I'm thinking about the varying groups that came to the forefront to help put him into the White House. Women, various minority groups, various religious groups. I think about those groups when I think about the black vote and protecting the black vote. I don't see, and I'm curious as to your thoughts, I don't see, and I think we need this, a rising up of some of these other groups about the attacks that have been waged against the black vote. When people went to the streets and said, oh, you know, after the Shelby County decision, when you saw the people who were angry about that, you saw mostly African Americans who were angry about that. You saw NAACP members in, you know, southern jurisdictions who were concerned about this. But I didn't necessarily see my brothers and sisters from other communities who said, you know what, if this is happening to you, it's happening to all of us. And I really feel like there's got to be this sense of community and this sense of this is a fight for all of us. This is not just about the African-American vote. This is about our democracy. And I think that has got to be a part of our future and how we continue to advance and protect the democracy. But I'd love to hear your thoughts about that.
You know, all the things we are talking about don't exist in isolation. So, of course, the larger frame is people hysterical about security since 9/11 and hysterical about the economy since 2008. It doesn't matter that these things are better. You know, somehow it's really got in on people and fractured, the Commonwealth in a way. People are anxious about the economy, and so they're not feeling very generous about other people getting help or helping other people or doing something other than worrying about their patch, their future, their kids, their bills, their college, that sort of thing. And then also there's just this kind of atmosphere of I'm perfectly willing in theory to give up my rights so long as I'm not going to be bombed. You know, there's a sort of lot of willingness to sacrifice individual rights in theory for security, or they've been asked to. And so, in a way, all of this attacks the sense of there being a public that we share, public space, public psychology, public narrative, all of that is sort of broken apart. And I'm not sure we'll get it back in this generation. But I have a lot of hope in the young, just because they're young. You know, that maybe it will seem different to them, mm-hmm. or there'll be different concerns, you know, that will galvanize them or unite them again. But I think that fear keeps a lot of people away and at home, and anxiety. And just this idea that I think in the United States, a lot of people have no trouble admitting that black people are superior, those people over there and on TV or in sports and this and that. or they don't have any trouble admitting that black people are inferior or sort of worse off. I think they have a very hard time saying that black people are the same. And so this would apply down the road. And then, too, blacks and whites aren't alone anymore. There are all these other confusing minority things going on, like, you know, who are these Hispanic people and what are they talking about, and things like that. So I think it's sort of recognizing what the country has turned into and trying to salvage those traditions that helped. My father used to say the reason the U.S. Army was the best in the world was that the U.S. high school system was the best in the world. And so now that our educational system has pretty much fallen apart, you know, everything is in jeopardy. The biggest problem in the U.S. is still residential segregation, and everything comes from that. Your access to schools and on and on and on. And so we still have these fundamental problems, but they express themselves as people not believing they share a common destiny. And we certainly just do still.
Is that a reason why perhaps we need mandatory voting, as the president
yes.
was just talking about last week, to compel or Americans to voice their opinions and to be engaged as one when it comes to the electorate?
I think a lot of Americans have a fear. You know, they don't feel they belong or that they're a part of, or they want to stay under the radar. You know, they just don't feel they belong. You know, it's a kind of psychological thing that they can't sort of join in for one reason or another, especially the poor. And there are many more white poor people than black poor people, but we don't know them because they're taught that as whites, if they're poor, they're real failures and down there with blacks, and, you know. And so you never hear from them. Not really. Except in unions, mm-hmm. but those are the working poor. That's mm-hmm. not, you know. And I don't know.
And the voice of the unions is not quite as strong as it used to be.
No, but, you know, everything is sort of different. When I was growing up, newspapers were family-owned from city to city to city. So every newspaper had some investment in what was going on and also knew what was going on. Then, because of Kay Graham, all these widows discovered they were sitting on a fortune. So they sold off all their newspapers, and they were sort of run by syndicates, and then that local involvement wasn't there anymore. Now newspapers hardly matter because the whole way of delivering news has changed so much. But, you know, people sort of can't find themselves in the way the country looks now. They don't really see themselves. Mm-hmm. Everyone's in a sort of different place, more or less.
Find us on the web at www.brennancenter.org.